We'll hear arguments first this afternoon in Dirks against the Securities Exchange Commission. Mr. Bonderman, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the Court. 10 years ago today, in fact, virtually at this hour, Petitioner Dirks was in the office of Stanley Goldblum, Chairman of the Board, President, and Chief Executive Officer of then High-Flying Equity Funding Corporation of America. Justice White, it was at 10 o'clock in the morning, California time. Mr. Dirks was there to confront Mr. Goldblum with uncorroborated allegations of a fired former officer of a subsidiary to the effect, in relevant part, that the major foundations of the company, its life insurance subsidiary, were a fraud, and that the company was carrying on its books substantial amounts of, quote, phony policies, unquote, which were being sold to reinsurers as though they were real in a Ponzi scheme. Mr. Goldblum, of course, denied all, arranged for a meeting which lasted much of the day with all of the other major officers of the company, in an endeavor to persuade Mr. Dirks that these allegations were entirely spurious and were being circulated by a disgruntled former fired employee who, although Mr. Dirks hadn't mentioned his name, Mr. Goldblum knew who it was. Sechrist had come to Dirks 10 days earlier with these and other allegations, some of which ultimately proved to be true, some of which proved to be false. He had come to Dirks because Dirks had a reputation as an analyst who was willing to investigate beyond just looking at reports, the bottom line financial analysis, because, as the Court of Appeal below found, the Securities and Exchange Commission had a history of failing to act promptly in dealing with what has come to be known as the equity funding scandal, the SEC having been informed by one of its own former attorneys a year and a half earlier and having taken essentially no actions, a quick investigation which was closed, the SEC again being informed within 2 days of Mr. Dirks, but again concluding that there was nothing there and not taking any action at that time. Sechrist had the idea that in view of the performance by the regulators and in view of the notion within the company that the company had connections through its associate general counsel to the SEC, which made it clear that the SEC would never act, and through its vice president to the Illinois Insurance Commission, which also assured that the Insurance Commission, which had regulatory authority, would never act. The only way to publicize what Sechrist believed, though, as he admitted, he had no proof, was a major, perhaps the major, fraud in corporate America at the time, was to have somebody like Dirks go out, do such investigation as he could, and to publicize those allegations in the only way a securities analyst can, by telling everybody he can get his hands on, with the result that the trading in the stock would cause an adjustment in the price.
Mr. Bonderman, we're dealing here, I guess, only with the activities of Mr. Dirks in those few days before he went to the SEC.
That is correct, Justice O'Connor, from the 7th of March until the 26th of March.
Why shouldn't he have gone in the first place to the SEC and then gone ahead and done all the things that he did?
Well, there are two answers to that. I'd like to start with the second one, if I might. The second one is that the SEC's position is that even if he had, he would have violated the law because it is no defense that you reported it to the SEC.
Well, but I suppose you could argue to us that it should be a defense that he reported it to the SEC. That's another question.
That brings me to what I suppose perhaps should have been my first. It was reported to Dirks by Mr. Sechrist that the SEC was aware and had been informed in 1971. That was correct. The courts below so found.
But isn't it his obligation to go as a broker-dealer to the SEC? You would acknowledge that at some point it's his obligation. Would you or would you not?
Well, the answer to that is, I would say, first, if he has an obligation to go to the SEC at all,
does he ever, in your view,
have
an obligation?
I believe not, but I believe that that is not material here because under the facts present, what he had was a rumor, an unverified allegation, perhaps more than a rumor, but certainly less than fact, of the sort that goes on in the market all the time. In fact, Stanley Sporkin, the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission's Division of Enforcement at the time, who was called before Congress and asked why was it that the SEC didn't take action when Dirks did go there on the 26th, they said,
if you would assume for purposes of answering the question that his obligation as a licensee to be a broker-dealer does obligate him to go to the SEC with the information, then could you agree that he ought to go there first?
I think the answer to that is no, because I believe that Mr. Dirks did, in fact, go to the SEC himself, although Sechrist told him on the 19th of March that Sechrist had gone to the SEC. That turned out to be inaccurate. Indirectly, the information was brought to the SEC's attention on the 9th. I believe that the record here is clear that Mr. Dirks went to the SEC on the 26th, at the very first time, certainly the very first working day, that he had anything beyond speculation allegation. After he had checked it out, he and Mr. Blundell from the Wall Street Journal, who was in fact the first person that Mr. Dirks talked to, did in fact go to the SEC. I might add that Mr. Dirks had a very personal additional reason for not going to the SEC, because the last time he was involved in an investigation, he had done just what you suggest. Some clients of his, this involved a prior case, the ITT Hartford merger.
Is this in the record?
Yes, it is. It is in the record. Mr. Dirks, in that case, had gone to the SEC because he heard from some of his clients that insider trading was going on, and he went to the SEC and told them, and requesting if they could please keep his name out of it because his clients wouldn't appreciate his sharing their confidences with the SEC. The first thing the SEC did was call up the clients and said, Dirks here is alleging that you know thus and such about inside information and inside trading in the Hartford case. Needless to say, Mr. Dirks himself was personally disencouraged because of that experience for going to the SEC before he believed he had facts, which he did not have, we believe.
Well, I suppose the SEC, as affirmed by the Court of Appeals, though, found that the information he had during the days before he went to the SEC was material, specific, and detailed.
Well, the answer to that is in part yes, although what the Commission really found was at least, and the administrative law judge is the same, saying at least, forgetting what happened early on, at least by the weekend between the 23rd and 26th, he had such information. In fact, the information that Dirks had was brought to the attention of Mr. Sporkin on a telephone call by Mr. Blundell of the Wall Street Journal on the evening of the 23rd of March, which happened to have been a Friday. Dirks came in and testified starting on the following Monday, the 26th, testified for 3 days, at the end of which time Mr. Sporkin testified before Congress that the SEC had nothing but hearsay, innuendo, and rumor, and nothing on which it could act. That was the SEC's position in testimony before Congress about what Dirks knew. That's after Dirks spent 3 days telling it. I'd like to talk about...
Before you go on with that...
Yes, sir, Mr.
When
Chairman.
A citizen, private citizen goes to the SEC, as they sometimes go to the FBI, Department of Justice, or a newspaper, are there any regulations that, first, that would guarantee them anonymity? Second, beyond that, are there any protections from liability for slander or libel if they do it in writing?
The answer to both questions is, as far as I know, there are none. And
They go at their own risk, then, don't they?
I believe they do. In fact, you raise a very good point, because when Dirks started to make his checks in the industry and ask people, look, you know how reinsurers operate. Is this scheme possible? Because it made no sense. It was a Ponzi scheme. Is this scheme possible? He was cautioned, don't say anything to anybody. You're going to get yourself in trouble. There are libel laws here. You be very cautious about what you say. So the truth is that you're caught between a rock and a hard place, in the sense that an analyst like Dirks has no access to the press. He went to the Wall Street Journal. That was the first thing he did. They declined to print the story. The testimony was that they can't print a story on hearsay allegations. They didn't act on it, though they worked with Dirks, and ultimately, based on the information that Dirks uncovered, printed a story after the period of time we're talking about.
Now, on the other side of this equation, if it is an equation, I'm not sure, if a person, an analyst, securities analyst, has clients who depend upon him, would he be at risk for a malpractice if he had information and didn't give it to them?
Well,
is there any malpractice suit that's reached that area yet?
One of the defenses raised by the persons to whom Dirks gave information and who traded, and let me just digress for a second to say, Dirks told literally 100 people about this, some of whom bought, some of whom sold, some of whom did neither. Some of those, five of those persons who sold were charged in this proceeding below, and they defended themselves in part on the grounds that they were caught with two fiduciary obligations, assuming for the moment that this was inside information, which I don't believe for a minute it is. They had two fiduciary obligations, one to their clients, pension funds, for example, for whom they were trustee. Information comes to them. They have an obligation to act for those trustees, and they have an obligation not to violate the law with respect to this information. The courts below, or this commission, because it never got to the court below, held that whatever your other fiduciary obligations are, they gives you no license to violate these laws. I think the question is an open one. It was decided by the administrative law judge, but I'm not aware of any further decisions on that point. What happens here, if you think about the public policy implications of what was done, and indeed why the Solicitor General and the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Criminal Division filed a brief urging reversal, is that, as one commentator put it, you have here the biggest boon for the successful commission and continuation of fraud that can be imagined, because what you have done to somebody in Dirks's position is to tell him that the only thing he can do without risking a securities violation is to do what counsel suggested below. Nothing. That is to say, to be silent. Why do I say that? Because you recall that Dirks himself didn't trade. He didn't own any stock. Neither he nor his company traded a single share. What he did was tell everybody he could get his hands on, which included the auditors, which included the Wall Street Journal, which included a whole series of persons in the securities business, large and small. As the SEC found, he basically responded to other people's calls.
Could Mr. Dirks and his firm have traded in the stock on their own during that interval of time?
Well, the answer to that is I think there is an argument that they could, and I think that there is an argument that they couldn't.
So what's your position?
My position is that if those members of the court in Chiarella, who expressed a view that misappropriation of information is grounds under 10b-5 and 17a for violation, and the information came to Dirks on the theory that he was going to disseminate it, if he instead used it solely for his own private trading, it might be argued that he misappropriated it. I think that's wrong, but I think a substantial argument can be made based on that branch of Chiarella. I think there is no argument that can be made, no reasonable argument that can be made, that where Sechrist reasonably concluded that the only way to get this out, in view of what Sechrist understood to be the SEC's defaults in investigating, and which the courts below found to be the SEC's defaults in investigating it, the only way to get this out was to do what Dirks did, and Dirks didn't trade but did get it out. There is no grounds under Chiarella to find that any person breached any duty to anyone.
Would your — if the information that Mr. Dirks had received were merely adverse but not indicating criminal conduct, would petitioner have been liable as a tippy for the failure to disclose?
I think the answer to that is probably
clearly
yes. That's
right?
Correct. And that the reason that he is not liable here is because under no conceivable definition of the term insider information, as that has been used, inside information, could this possibly be inside information? And that's what the SEC forgot here. They made the incredible, and I think it is incredible, statement as the underlying basis for their rationale in this case, that Dirks should have known that this information was intended by the company to remain confidential. Indeed it was. Nobody who is committing a fraud desires to have it circulated, but yet that is the foundation for the whole insider trading rules and regulations stemming from Investors Management, the notion of improper dissemination. There was nothing improper about what Mr. Sechrist chose to do. He had two choices as a fiduciary. The fraud was going on. He could do either of two things. He could, as the commission suggests, he should have done nothing whatsoever, and allowed it to continue. Instead, he chose to follow a path which led to its disclosure sooner rather than later. And that is because, and it is a proven fact in this case, so found by the Court of Appeal, that reporting this information to public officials got nowhere in the past. That isn't and shouldn't come to anybody as a shock, although this case is a little more egregious as to what it is that public officials overlooked, because entire statutory enforcement schemes, indeed the whole reason we have a 10b-5, a private right of action at all, is a recognition that no matter how well motivated and intentioned and whatever skillful a job they're doing, regulators simply cannot probe and uncover all instances where enforcement is appropriate. That's why we have private enforcement not only in 10b-5, in the antitrust statutes, throughout the federal regime. It's why we have informers' rewards. It's why we try to encourage dissemination and uncovery of fraud.
But if you're right, and if there is no accompanying obligation on Mr. Dirks to go right away to the SEC and disclose the information, then that would build in an incentive to people who might uncover this information to continually selectively disseminate it and to extend that time as long as possible to maximize their profits.
Well, let me answer that this way, if I might, Justice O'Connor. First of all, I think Commissioner Smith in Investors Management gave the right response to the notion of selective dissemination. That's a spit word the SEC has invented, and it means nothing. Because what does selective dissemination mean? If it means you didn't make it public because you didn't put it on the wire, of course, they're right. No one would put this on the wire. The Wall Street Journal wouldn't publish it. If it means that you chose a few people to select for profit and didn't try to get it out as broadly as possible, that's not what was done here. The court below found —
Well, but if you're right, it might be done in the future by others.
If, in fact, someone uses it to line their pocket in a direct sense, I think we have a different case and, indeed, maybe can have a different rule. But I would like to suggest that the entire theoretical underpinnings, as referring the Court, for example, to Professor Easterbrook's seminal article on this, suggest that there's nothing wrong with the notion if what you're talking about is encouraging people to investigate fraud, and the choice is to have them not investigate fraud, what are the costs you're willing to pay to encourage someone? If, in fact, Dirks, because of his own personality, did this essentially for free. He did, in fact, do it essentially for free. His company received one indirect commission. But you can't expect people to spend their own time and incur costs to investigate fraud doing that. In fact, it has never been the case in this society that I'm aware, that people's altruism was supposed to contribute solely and 100% to their doing of acts that the society regards as good. That goes for all of us in this courtroom.
Put on Dirks apply to anybody else who isn't a broker-dealer?
That depends if you believe that Judge Wright's single-judge opinion creating a broker-dealer duty to the whole world, which he announced was breached. If that were the rationale, I suppose it would apply to all broker-dealer employees.
How about non-broker-dealers?
It would apply to anybody else who has an ethical standard of special care. I think.
Well, what if the Wall Street Journal had published the information?
I'm sorry?
What if the Wall Street Journal had published the information?
Well, if the question is whether they would now have a privilege against the libel laws,
I don't think
they would.
What about the could the SEC get after them?
I think even the SEC would admit that publishing it in the Wall Street Journal makes it public. Putting it out over the wire makes it public. I think even the SEC would admit that. Beyond that, they will not go.
No, but that's using inside information. That's publicizing.
As I understand, the SEC.
Well, if Dirks had put out a big flyer and handed it out in a supermarket, would he have been any better off?
No. Because the SEC takes the position. And did take the position here. In fact, the administrative law judge said it was a position, quote, of great merit, unquote, that the only way that you can protect yourself against a charge of fraud is to make it public in the sense of putting it on the tape.
Could the SEC have got after some of Dirks's tippies?
They did.
And who are not broker-dealers or anything else?
They did.
And so anybody who is a tippie using inside information is subject to SEC sanction?
Yes, because the theory, the SEC has taken a walk on
including
both.
Including a newspaper, I suppose.
If the newspaper traded or someone used it to trade and it wasn't making it public, I suppose you could think of a case of some newspaper of very small circulation in some little town in South Carolina.
Well, what about Dirks? I said, what if he hadn't told any of his clients? He just made a sign.
Well,
he just made a sign that said so-and-so is a fraudulent outfit and stuck it up at the corner of something in Wall Street.
That is not public disclosure because the persons who don't go by Broad and Wall, for example, people trading in Seattle, Washington, never find out about it. In fact, one of the trading defendants, Dreyfus, did disclose. They disclosed substantially everything that Dirks had told them on the 23rd to Goldman Sachs, to whom they sold some stock. And the SEC argued, and the administrative law judge found, these folks didn't appeal, that even had they done so, he said there was great merit in the notion that that isn't enough. You can't simply tell who you're dealing with. You have to make it public. That is the whole point of the SEC's argument.
Well, if the SEC's basis for assertion of authority here is the broker-dealer relationship, what action could they take to enforce the same sort of obligation against someone who is not a broker-dealer and who therefore isn't subject to disciplinary proceedings?
Well, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, that is not the SEC's position. The SEC has taken a walk on Judge Wright's opinion.
Right.
They say to this court in footnote 27 that we don't deal with Judge Wright's opinion. Chenery precludes it. It wasn't advanced below. The commission didn't rely on it. This court shouldn't. We don't adopt it. It
applies to everybody.
Their view is that anybody who gets any information from inside the company automatically, that's the other half of Judge Wright's opinion,
is
automatically has a duty to disclose. It comes from out of thin air.
Perhaps this question should be better put to your opponent, but how would the SEC propose to enforce that duty against someone who's not a broker-dealer?
They would propose to sue them in a federal court. I presume they have done so in other cases. Perhaps they might, as they did with Mr. Chiarella.
What would they sue for? They could probably.
Would sue for aiding and abetting violations of 10b-5 by someone who traded. That's what they did here. They sued Dirks.
Ultimately, what would they ask for?
Well, isn't the real liability to the purchaser in those facts? If it's a 10b-5 violation and without being the broker-dealer, isn't there a tremendous damage liability?
There is a tremendous damage liability. Dirks here, for example, was sued in huge class actions. No one recovered from him because he refused to settle and ultimately never went to trial. But also, thinking back to Chiarella, let's not forget that this is a criminal statute. What's to prevent the Dirkses of the future from being indicted for this? If this court says that Dirks did wrong here, the next time somebody will think about whether the SEC is going to send him to jail for doing this. And it is hard to believe of anything that would be as contraindicated for someone who is attempting to disclose a fraud, even if he didn't do it perfectly.
May I ask you one question here about your theory? I understand the objections to your opponent's theories, but under your view, if everything hinges on the character of the information, that it's illegal and therefore there's no protection to it, it does follow, does it not, that you would say that he would not be liable even if he had traded directly and never told him. He just kept it secret and decided to make as much money out of it as he could.
Well, I think in fairness the answer is not quite, because what our theory has been is that under Chiarella, looking at the majority, concurrence and dissents, there should be no liability for information where there is no breach of a duty.
Well, in the case I posit, under your view, there's no breach of a duty. I don't know why you're afraid to make the argument.
Well, the answer to that
he's got information. He came into his possession lawfully. There's nothing privileged about it because the more people find out about it, the better. And his market activity will eventually cause the information to be known more generally.
I agree with that, and we do argue that. But we can go a step further here because of what Dirks did and the way it has come to.
No, but if the heart of your argument is no duty.
That is correct.
Then it seems to me it applies in that situation as well as this one.
That is the heart of our argument. We also recognize, however, the misappropriation arguments that the Chief Justice made in his dissent. And what we're saying is it is at least possible to formulate a theory of misappropriation which wouldn't apply here, which might apply if Sechrest had come to Dirks and said, look, disseminate this, as in fact Dirks did, but instead Dirks went home and traded on it for his own use, and that's all he did. It seems to me there might be a misappropriation argument along the lines made by the Chief Justice in Chiarella. So we recognize that such an argument is a possibility.
If that's the test, why wasn't it a misappropriation to, even if he got only one indirect commission out of it, to that extent? Wasn't there still a violation of the duty?
I don't think so, because everybody recognized that at least Sechrest's plan, if that's what it could be called, was that Dirks would do exactly what he did do, which was tell everybody in sight. Which was not simply clients, he told competitors. He told people he never heard of, people who called him up on the telephone. He told the Ford Foundation.
But not the SEC.
He had reason to believe that the SEC knew, reason which was accurate. He was told by Sechrest on the 19th of March that the SEC knew. He was told by Sechrest on the 7th of March that the SEC had been told about it repeatedly over
a
period of years.
Well, I guess I still don't understand what would be the matter with a rule that said the broker-dealer can discharge his obligations, if there are any, by telling the SEC and then going ahead and doing whatever he wants because he's made it public. Now, what's the matter with that?
That argument is inconsistent, as I understand it, both with the SEC's position and with the entire underlying basis for the development of the law, being that it is non-public. The fact that I tell the SEC, obviously this Court can change my mind as to what the law has been, but obviously if I tell the SEC, it doesn't make it public. And because the whole notion stems from a parity of information concept along the lines rejected by this Court in Chiarella, the truth is if there is no parity of information or anything like it, because if I tell the SEC and it goes in their investigatory file, it is still non-public in any sense that has ever been used.
It's in the hearsay file.
That's exactly where it is. It's still non-public. And I believe that Mr. Gonson would tell you that and will tell you that in response to those questions. Thank you. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Mr. Gonson.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Raymond Dirks was censured by the Commission for passing material, non-public information he had received from equity funding to five institutions. On the basis of that information, they sold more than $17 million worth of equity funding securities to investors who did not know that those securities were virtually worthless. In imposing only a censure, the Commission took into account Mr. Dirks' role in bringing to light the massive fraud at equity funding as a result of his investigation. But while his role mitigated any sanction to be imposed upon him as a result of his unlawful tipping activities, it did not excuse them.
Was anybody at SEC censured?
Was anybody in the Commission censured? So far as I'm aware, no, Your Honor. Let me address the question of the information to the SEC, which is set forth in both of our briefs. The events that are involved in this case took place in 1973. In 1971, a former attorney who worked on the staff of the SEC called to say that two employees of the SEC, one Mercado and one Templeton, had information about irregularities at equity funding. We asked that they be sent in. They were sent in, but they were very circumspect. They did not tell the kind of story that the lawyer promised that they would. We followed up on it, and we were unable to get that information. At a later time, the attorney for Mercado, who became concerned that his client had gone to the SEC unaccompanied by counsel, then came, and then there's an issue which counsel raises as to whether an offer of immunity was made whereby Mercado allegedly would discuss that. From the SEC staff's memorandum, it was never perceived that such an offer was made. And so that matter was not pursued. On the 9th of March, which was 2 days after Sechrest told Dirks the story he had told him, the California Insurance Commission representative contacted a staff member in the Los Angeles office of the SEC to reveal in a very vague way that some allegations were being made, And the response was made that the California authorities should look into them, and it's a promise, if they bring fruit, to contact us again. And this has to be understood, I think, in the context that at that time, approximately 10,000 complaints were received. This back in 73 by the SEC. Today it's closer to 20,000 a year. And so the very detailed, hard story that Dirks knew and received from Sechrist, in which, by the way, he corroborated in great detail by talking at length with six former and present employees of Equity Funding, was not brought to the SEC. Rather, much vaguer, softer information had been. Now, it may assist analysis of this case to view Dirks, as did the administrative law judge in this case, as proceeding on two tracks. On the first track, which is what has been described to you, Dirks was seeking to confirm and expose what he believed was a fraud. And as the administrative law judge found, had Dirks confined his disclosure to the Wall Street Journal reporters, or had he gone to the authorities, quote, he might indeed have been perceived as the public-spirited hero he portrays himself, unquote. But there was a second track. Dirks informed his clients about this fraud. Sechrist testified that he wanted Dirks to disseminate information to his clients so that they would sell Equity Funding securities
but,
in large quantities.
I take it your position is it wouldn't have made any difference to the SEC if he had gone to the Wall Street Journal first and the SEC, and then the SEC, and then to his clients.
Well, the point of the case,
well,
Your Honor,
would it make any difference to you or not?
The question is whether the information should become public. The issue in this case is not an information issue. It is not whether the information did get or did get out or didn't
get
out.
Well, I just ask you again, what if he had just leave the Wall Street Journal out? Suppose he had just gone to the SEC and then went ahead and did what he did.
The SEC,
he'd still be in trouble with you.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Yes.
Our position is that this case is governed by a series of cases since 1961, those of the SEC and the courts.
So it would not have satisfied his obligation
right,
under
that,
the law
that,
to go to the
that's
SEC.
That's correct,
first.
That an insider has to observe what has come to be known as the abstain or disclose rule. Either the information has to be disclosed to the market, if it is inside information, which I'll get to, or the insider must abstain from trading. If the agency knows about it, but the information has not yet become publicly available,
and probably maybe never will be.
Well, it may very well be, but
well,
the fact that the agency
no
is investigating, the question, Your Honor, boils down to whether if someone has inside information, that person is free to trade on it if that information is not available to the market.
Well, of course, you're ordinary an analyst employed by any broker-dealer firm. Just he makes his living by analyzing rumors and that sort of thing, doesn't he? What did Dirks do that was so different here?
The Commission pointed out in its opinion that it views the role of analysts as very important and said that they perform valuable functions in putting forth their analytical skills and evaluating data and then putting them together in what has sometimes been referred to as a mosaic. They take perhaps what might be inconsequential bits of information to others, and because of other information they know and their analytical skills, they can make predictions and they can make suggestions as to the company will do or won't do. That is different, said the Commission, from the kind of devastatingly important information that would become obvious to anyone, that there was a massive fraud at Equity Funding. And the Commission said a line has to be drawn between the usual functions of analysts and their trading on inside information that would not be available to anyone. And the line is between what might be called fairness, as far as it's possible to do so, on the one hand, as against the role that analysts play on the other hand.
How does Dirks make anything public? How would he have made it public? You say his obligation is don't trade on it, information that is not public. Could he possibly satisfy his obligation to make it public?
He could have gone to the New York Stock Exchange, which he didn't do. He could have tried.
What would he have done
successful.
At the New York, what would he have done at the New York Stock Exchange?
The New York The New York Stock Exchange may have then taken action, as it ultimately did.
Well, they may not have either. They may not have taken any more action than the
That's
SEC
correct.
Did.
That's correct. If
so how could he do it?
It may be that he couldn't do it, Your Honor, but that if he couldn't do it, then he couldn't trade on it. The point is the question of whether
the only
one
way
is
he
a
could
trade.
Do it, if he traded himself, he should tell his customers. I mean, tell his purchasers.
If there's a way for him to do that, it's very difficult.
What if he insisted to his clients, now look, before you unload this bad stock, you should tell the person that you're unloading it on that it's bad.
That is the principle, Your Honor. Yes. Exactly right. It is difficult, of course, to do that when trading stock in an impersonal stock market. And thus, the information has to generally become public in some other way.
Well, I'm just not clear, then, what your response is to Justice White about what Mr. Dirks could have done to make it public. Would you explain that more clearly?
Yes, Your Honor. Dirks could have attempted to make it public by doing partly what he did, and that was pressing the Wall Street Journal reporter to publish a story. Eventually,
and
the Wall Street Journal
And if it weren't published, then what could he do?
Nothing.
If it weren't published and it otherwise did not become publicly available, then he could not have traded on it.
That's your position. Whether he told the Wall Street Journal, the SEC, or anybody else, as long as it wasn't public,
as long as it was not public. That's correct, Your Honor.
Mr. Godson, suppose Dirks had not been a broker-dealer, and still the information had come to him and he passed it on. I take it the SEC wouldn't have had any jurisdiction over him, but would the party who purchased the stock have a case against
well,
Dirks?
Well, to take the first part of your question, Your Honor, the SEC could have, I don't know whether it would have, instituted an injunctive action.
Against this non-broker-dealer.
Against the non-broker-dealer. Indeed, it has instituted a great many injunction actions against non-broker-dealers for what we refer to as insider trading violations.
Yes.
It seeks in those cases, where appropriate, to obtain disgorgement of the ill-gotten gains.
Suppose Mr. Dirks had told only Mr. Lawson of the Wall Street Journal and Mr. Lawson had used the information. Would Dirks be liable?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't quite catch your question.
Let's assume that Dirks was not a broker-dealer. The information came to him. He passed it on to Lawson of the Wall Street Journal. And Mr. Lawson told a friend of his who owned securities. Didn't publish, just told a friend. Who would be liable?
Your Honor, Your Honor is constructing a chain of what we refer to as tippees.
Well, would Dirks be liable? He told Lawson. He's not a broker-dealer.
Dirks would be liable if, as we have in the facts of this case, he received information from a person he knew as an insider, and the insider wanted him to transmit that information to others so others could sell. The answer is yes, Dirks would be liable.
Even though Lawson himself owned no stock.
If Lawson traded on the basis of that information.
Well, he told his friend. How far does the chain go?
The chain goes as far, Your Honor, as persons who know that they receive information from an inside source and intend or reasonably expect either that they or the person they tell it to will trade on it. Mm-hmm. That's how far it goes. It may reach a point where persons may not know the source.
So each member of the chain would be liable?
Assuming those...
If they knew.
Yes.
Otherwise, all kinds of devious arrangements could be made to bypass the effect of these laws. Mm-hmm. Now, if I may get back to the second track I spoke of. Secrest wanted Dirks to disseminate information to his clients so that Dirks would sell these securities in large quantities. That would depress the price, according to Secrest, and that would cause the regulators to take notice.
So did Secrest want to make a private profit, or was he just interested in exposing it?
So far as the record shows, Secrest was just interested in exposing. He testified, as a matter of fact, that Dirks testified as well, that Dirks asked Secrest, did you sell this stock short? In other words, are you trying to induce me to do something with depressed price? Secrest said no. Secrest said that a friend of his had approached him and said, I'll put up the money, we'll sell the stock short, and then we'll divide the profits. But Secrest had rejected that out of hand.
Does the SEC take the position that a broker-dealer has an obligation to disclose to the SEC evidence of criminal conduct that that the broker-dealer learns of?
Your Honor, the SEC did not take that position in this case.
Does it take that position generally?
That the broker-dealer has an independent obligation to report crime to the SEC? Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
To report anything uncovered in the area of criminal activity? No. Is that
I'm
right?
I'm not aware that it has taken that position, Your Honor.
Not as part of the duties of the licensee or professional obligations of the licensee.
So far as I'm aware.
Do I correctly understand the SEC does not place any reliance on his status as a broker-dealer at this stage of the proceeding, other than for the discipline purpose?
That's correct, Your Honor, other than the fact that since he was a registrant, right, it was appropriate to proceed against him administratively.
But your
theory,
but the theory
of the case does not depend on
your theory would be
the
exactly the same if it were a non-broker-dealer. And is it not correct that if the same case arose in the future, it would subject the person who passed on the information without, when he shouldn't have, to a liability of around $17 million?
In a private action?
Yes.
Assuming the requisites for liability
assuming these
private
facts.
Action,
assuming these
private
facts.
Action were met, it could conceivably have that result, although there is case law which has developed in an area not germane to this case, delimiting, restricting the amount of recovery in terms of damage liability. But that is a separate issue, of course.
Well, does it follow here from your answer that if Blundell, or the reporter, had done everything that Dirks had done, that he might be liable?
If Blundell knew everything that Dirks knew,
yes,
and himself traded, the answer is yes, sure, Blundell would be liable. A question quite separate from the question as to whether he should publish something.
Well, he wouldn't be liable if he put it in the paper?
He would not be liable if he put it in the paper. This is not a disclosure case, Your Honor. We're talking about people who are trading in securities on the basis of undisclosed information.
What if it's a reporter for the Albuquerque Journal instead of the Wall Street Journal? Does publishing in the Albuquerque Journal about, say, a New York Stock Exchange traded security count is disclosure in your book?
It may, it may be adequate disclosure if, in fact, it probably would be. The other wire services would probably pick up that story and it would soon become available to the investment community.
Most individuals don't have access to a wire service that they can just go to their office and start typing out a message.
That's correct, Your Honor. You're raising a question which has been asked before, and that is, assuming somebody is not in a position to compel public disclosure of an inside fact that person knows, then very well-established case law, and as a matter of fact discussed in this Court's Chiarella's decision, establishes that person may not trade.
May I ask one other question, please? Supposing during the period between, I think it was March 7th and the time he went out to the West Coast, he had nothing but the Sechrist source of information, which were the bad facts but no verification. Was he then under a duty to refrain or disclose?
That raises the question, Your Honor, as to whether that information was material. And that, of course, is a closer question than much later when he had confirmed that with six former equity funding insiders. The Commission found that it was material, that it was very specific. It came from a source which Dirks himself said was a credible source. It was a 3.5-hour, very detailed conversation. The Commission found that, yes, it was. But I'm not sure that this Court need reach that because trades, of course, were made throughout that period, and most of them at the very end of the period, when by that time the information had been confirmed in great detail by others who had seen or witnessed others participate.
But the duty arises when the information becomes material, and, of course, you're not entirely sure when it's material until you get the additional information, I guess.
Well, the question of materiality is a question, I suppose, that
that's what triggers
difficult
the
to
duty.
Assess at the time. Yes,
that's what triggers the duty.
That's correct. Materiality information.
Mr. Gonsol, we're not giving you much of a chance to argue your case, but there's so many interesting questions. Suppose, let me put it this way. How long would Sechrist be deemed the possessor of inside information? Suppose he withheld it for 4 or 5 years. No one else had ever discovered it. He obviously didn't owe any duty not to disclose confidential information to equity, did he?
No, he did not, Your
Honor. He did not.
No argument made.
But
he owed duties to shareholders, not to the corporate.
If he had finally concluded 5 years later that he had a guilty conscience, he should have disclosed it sooner. He then told a friend, and the friend who owned the equity stock sold. I suppose there's no statute of limitation that runs against a former insider.
By virtue of the fact that he knew the information for a long time?
Yes.
I think
one might assume that the information had was no longer accurate or dependable not in this case, why the fraud was manifest.
Well, that raises a number of questions, Your Honor. Was the information material? Was it then public? And I think the fact that he knew about it a long time is not as relevant as the fact that the person who was receiving it learned it only then.
Yeah.
And the question then would be, was it material? And, of course, we would have to look for a duty, which I'd like to get to. And if it was received and in a breach of duty, then and the person knew that it was coming from an insider, then he would be disabled from trading on it.
An obligation Dirk's clients owed to their buyers have anything to do with inside information? It wouldn't, would it? It's just that they have information they should have disclosed.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So they may have a duty, an independent duty under 10B or?
Their duty, Your Honor, is derivative of secret's duty in this case.
Well, why is that? It's just that they had information they should have disclosed to their buyer. And it wouldn't make any difference whether it was inside information or not, would it?
Your Honor, this case is about secret's duty as an insider.
I understand
and persons
that.
Who stand in his shoes.
But what could suppose a holder of equity stock who gets hold of some inside information and decides to sell his stock because he doesn't think it's worth what it should be, and he sells it. Now, what can the company do to him? He can't. What is there to disgorge?
Are you speaking of whether the company has a right of action?
Yes,
Your Honor. The company, we discussed that in our brief. If I may answer your question very briefly,
all right.
if there was no duty of confidentiality owed to the company, then the company probably would have
no
action.
What if there was a duty?
But this is far afield from the case that we have.
Well, what if there was
us.
A duty? Suppose there's a duty. What can the company
a duty
do?
Owed to the company?
Mm-hmm.
Then the company might take some action for
like
breach
what?
Of that duty.
Like, what could he make him disgorge?
If he had received a profit in breach
of
a duty.
Well, he didn't make a profit. He avoided a loss.
That would raise a question, Your Honor, I'm not in a position to answer. I don't know whether and to what extent the corporation would be able to recover. But if I may return to the principal issue in this case, the issue is one of whether secret's duty either to abstain for trading or to disclose the information devolved upon Dirks. The commission held that Dirks stood in the shoes of secret's and, like secret's, had a duty to disclose the equity funding fraud to those he traded with or caused others to trade.
And did Sechrist, in the view of the commission, commit the same offense, whatever that may be, that Dirks committed?
If the facts support the answer as yes, Your Honor. Sechrist testified that he told Dirks this information, hoping that Dirks would give that information in turn to his clients, that the clients would trade, and that the impact of the trading would lower the stock price dramatically, and that would cause the regulators
to take notice. Did the commission ever go after Sechrist?
So far as I'm aware, the commission didn't. Sechrist, of course, would not be amenable, not being a registrant with the agency.
Well,
to the
theory, I thought, was broad enough so that liability didn't depend on the fact
it does not, Your Honor. But in this proceeding, which was an administrative proceeding, then, of course, persons would be amenable to that proceeding only if they're registered.
So
the answer is no.
In the commission's view, Dirks's conduct was bad, but Sechrist's wasn't.
I suppose perhaps you're drawing an implicit assumption based upon the fact that the commission chose to proceed against Dirks and not against Sechrist.
I leave the assumption drawing to you.
Well, it's just that there's a particular kind of a remedy available against Dirks that isn't available against Sechrist.
That is exactly correct. And, of course, while we are here in this court only with regard to Dirks, the commission's administrative proceeding was against the five institutions who had received the information from Dirks as well.
Could a staff member of the SEC ever be an insider in terms of the statute?
Oh, certainly, Your Honor. We have all kinds of elaborate rules that prevent staff members from trading on securities.
When information first came to them from whatever sources about this, is there some procedure to deal with failures to act as distinguished from acting to take advantage of the inside information?
That is, if the staff members had been derelict in their duty and not following through, there are administrative procedures that
these
exist
are just
in the federal government.
Or these are disciplinary procedures, I take it.
Yes, but in retrospect, I suppose there are other kinds of information that may come to the SEC, and as I explained, some 20,000 complaints a year that may later turn out to be something that the staff persons at that time felt were not as important as other complaints. I don't know whether that was so in 1970.
I get from that you suggest that the SEC is sometimes skeptical of the information it gets.
Well, sometimes, Your Honor. It's a question, I think, of caseload and volume, where the commission
certainly
has...
I would not assume that the SEC would believe and accept every rumor that comes to their attention.
No, of course, it certainly does not. And it investigates a great many of them.
But when there are repeated rumors focusing on one area, that certainly should trigger SEC action, should it not?
It generally does, Your Honor, if you're talking about a large number of complaints that are made or complaints over a period of time. But what we're talking about here is a complaint, if you'll call it that, in 1971, and then another one in 1973. Neither one conveying very much in the way of detailed information. If I may return to the question of duty, the Commission in this case dealt with Sechrist and Dirk. Sechrist was an insider, and as an insider owed a duty to shareholders of Equity Funding and to those who were to become shareholders by the very act of buying the stock, and that duty was a duty of disclosure to them, a duty not to defraud them. And that duty rests upon the fiduciary relationship recognized in the common law between the corporate insider and the shareholder, and not on the separate and distinct duty of the insider to the corporation to preserve the confidentiality of the corporation's secrets. Now, Dirks and the Solicitor General, who has filed a brief in this case, confuse these two duties. They disregard the duty to the shareholders. They argue instead that because Sechrist had no duty to keep confidential the information about the fraud, he breached no duty to Equity Funding. Now, this Court recognized in the Chiarella case, in discussing the traditional prohibitions against insider trading by insiders and their tippees, that the duty to disclose inside information arises not from any obligation to the corporate source of the information, but from the, quote, relationship between the corporate insider and the stockholders of the corporation. The Court there referred, among other sources, to the Commission's Katie Roberts decision, in which the Commission had recognized that a relationship of trust and confidence exists between the shareholders of a corporation and its insiders, giving rise to a duty of disclosure in order to prevent a corporate insider from taking advantage of the uninformed shareholders. And the Court also referred to this Court's 1909 decision in Strong versus Rapide, essentially for a similar proposition. Now, the duty to shareholders is separate from the duty of confidentiality that the insider also owes to the corporation. And this case, as I mentioned before, is not about confidentiality. It is not about the corporation's interest in keeping the fraud quiet. It is about the shareholders' interest in knowing about the fraud and the insider's duty to tell them about it before.
But Mr. Gonson, may I interrupt there? If we just concentrate on duty to shareholders, how would the financial interests of the shareholders been served by a total disclosure of the fraud?
Of course, at any time when the fraud would become known, the stock would become worthless or virtually worthless, and whoever would be holding it at that time would have worthless stock. But I believe, and I think that this is probably an accurate statement, that people who buy stock assume the risk that some companies are not going to do well. I don't think that people assume the risk, however, that favored insiders are going to be able to bail out and dump their stock on them before that time comes.
No, but the people who are potentially victims of this in this situation are the people who may buy into the company.
That's
not
correct,
those
right.
who are already there.
That's
so you really should be, seems to me, be focusing on the duty to potential future shareholders. Because existing shareholders, it just cuts the other direction.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. In the Chiarella case, this court quoted Judge Learned Hand's reasoning in Gratz versus Claught in the Second Circuit case that, quote, the director or officer assumed a fiduciary relation to the buyer by the very sale, for it would be a sorry distinction to allow him to use the advantage of his position to induce the buyer into the position of a beneficiary, although he was forbidden to do so once the buyer had become one. And our position, and the Commission said, Your Honor, that just as Secrets could not trade, his tippies Dirks could not trade, and Turks and Dirks tippies, the institutions, could not trade.
Everyone should go down together.
So long, Your Honor, as they know that the information comes from an insider, it was communicated with the intention that purchasers be defrauded, that intention was carried out, and everybody who is in that chain, Your Honor, ought to be disabled for trading on that information.
Again, I'll ask what I asked a while ago. If Dirks and his tippies had disclosed everything they knew to their buyers, would that have discharged their duty to the stockholders of equity?
Yes, it would, Your Honor. If there were a way, yes. Certainly, that's the principle of the case. If the buyer of the stock is given full disclosure, all the facts, the material facts known
that
by the seller,
that discharges the duty not only to the buyer but to the stockholders.
It discharges the duty to those who are purchasers in response to Justice Stevens. Very precise question.
I thought you said the insider owes a duty to the stockholders.
He owes a duty to the stockholders not to deceive them.
Well, he isn't deceiving them. He just goes and sells his stock and he tells the buyer exactly what the facts are.
And as I mentioned by quoting...
Now, does that satisfy the duty to the stockholders?
Yes, Your Honor. When I speak to duty of the stockholders, I'm referring to the possible other side of the case, where the insider, as was the case in Strong versus Repeat in this court, buys the stock. Then, of course, he would breach the duty to that stockholder in purchasing without disclosure of material information because of the fiduciary relationship that he bears to them. When he sells stock, then he breaches the duty to the purchaser, who by that very act of fraud, if you will, then becomes the shareholder.
Mr. Constant, I just want to be clear about this, but as I understand your position, it's perfectly immaterial that Dirk's firm profited by the information he disseminated. That's immaterial to your position, isn't it?
Well, I think it is immaterial to our legal position.
Immaterial to your basic theory.
It is immaterial, yes, to the basic theory.
Right.
Although it provides, of course, some reason for him.
It provides some color, but that's really all, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor. This was the second track I referred to, which I never was able to develop, that he was pursuing
but the liability,
with equal vigor.
The liability would have existed even if there had been no profit whatever.
That's correct, Your Honor, because potentially under the theory of this case, Dirks was free to have enjoyed that $17 million profit.
And may I ask an irrelevant question? Is it a fact that the Wall Street Journal was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize and Dirks was prosecuted?
Is that an irrelevant fact?
I said, is it a fact? I don't know whether it's a fact or not.
I've been told it is a fact, but then their two activities were very much different.
But would it strike you as curious from the standpoint of society in general if that were true?
Your Honor, it does not strike me as curious, if I may answer the question. If one discovers a crime and is on his way to the police station to tell them about it and decides on the way to take a little piece of it himself, then I think that tarnishes his image as a hero. If another person publishes an article and does not profit himself, I think there is a distinction. That does not strike me as curious.
Well, do you have anything further, Mr. Bonderson?
If I might make a few brief points in my remaining time, I'd like to answer Justice White's questions. The SEC's position is not that everybody should go down together. It's that the fraud should be allowed to continue because all incentive for anybody, whether it's Sechrist or Dirks, to disseminate any such information if they don't have access to a wire should be withdrawn from them because they should risk SEC proceeding $17 million liability.
Dirks could get off the hook by making the whole thing public. In which event, everybody would go down together.
Except Dirk couldn't make it public. He tried as best he could. He didn't have a wire service. No one would print these defaults.
Well, suppose it was printed.
If the Wall Street Journal had, in fact, published it, which it refused to do, I would believe that the SEC would have said, okay, thereafter it's public. But
then everybody can take his chances.
That's right. But the truth is that Dirks, remember, didn't trade. He told everybody. This isn't a trading without disclosure. Well, please. Dirks told everybody he could.
Let me ask you one other question about your theory. What about assuming that Sechrist had traded? Mm-hmm. Would there be liability for Sechrist?
I think so.
Why?
Because I believe that it is not us, but the SEC is confused as to whom Mr. Sechrist has a duty. He has a duty, first to the shareholders, not to profit himself. I believe that. Secondly, he has a duty to the public to disclose fraud. That's what he was trying to do. If instead what he had done is simply taking the information, put it in his pocket, and lined his pocket, we wouldn't have the implication that we do here of a man who is trying to disseminate the fraud.
If he tried to tell the Wall Street Journal just as Dirk did, and the Wall Street Journal wouldn't publish, and then he said, well, the only way I can get this into the public is by selling and causing the market to fall and cause an investigation. Would he still be liable?
I think that's a tough case. I think he probably would, because Dirks is not in the same position under Chiarella and under the common law fiduciary cases as Sechrist is. Dirks had no contact with this company. He's not a fiduciary of the company. He had no contact with the stockholders. He wasn't in a position of faith and trust.
No, but if he had traditional inside information, he'd be in the same position.
But that's because there would have been a breach of duty, supposedly, in making that information available. Where, I ask you, is there any breach of duty? You have to go back. What's wrong with the SEC's position here and why their arguments make no sense and why they can't answer
your
questions?
Well, their argument is that the duty to refrain or disclose was something that imposed on Sechrist. He violated that, and the person to whom he disclosed had the same duty. That's their theory.
The problem with their theory is that it's obviously wrong. Did Sechrist have a duty not to disclose information relating to the criminal conduct? Let's go back and see where this whole tippy theory came from. The notion is that inside information is, in a sense, a corporate asset. It is information, good or bad, to be controlled by the corporation for its private purposes, whether it's Texas Gulf's strike good or McDonnell Douglas's collapse and dividend loss, which is bad, but to be released, and it will be released in due course by the company when the company has taken such legitimate advantage of it as it's entitled to. That's where the whole notion came from. Now, how can you possibly apply that theory to information with respect to an illegal ongoing fraud which the management has been concealing for 11 years and will conceal for the rest of all of our lives if it can? You cannot, I submit. That's why there was no breach of duty. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in...